it has been announced, Kedusha or Malchut, holiness and kingship. What I'm going to do tonight is to investigate Malchut as a political institution, monarchy as a political institution, and also as a metaphysical transcendental idea. I will try to define the attitude of Yehudus toward both monarchy as a political institution and as a great ethical idea. Malchut is inseparably linked up with the human quest for companionship and coexistence. Human sociability was decreed by the Almighty at the dawn of creation, when He, in His inscrutable wisdom, proclaimed that men, that loneliness is bad for man's growth and development. And in order to redeem man, or Adam, from his tragic solitude, He created Eve to join him. Indeed, man, because of fear of loneliness, has displayed a remarkable talent for setting up social entities and linking up his individual, solitary life with other beings, developing thus a complex system of human relations within the framework of social cross-reference and relatedness. Man tries to protect himself from the curse of being alone or being nobody. Whether he is successful in his quest for togetherness is a different problem, which I'm not going to investigate tonight. However, within the group which was formed in order to help man free himself from his loneliness, there is no ideal equality. Even though the constitution or the covenant by which the group was established or formed might rest upon democratic and liberal foundations, no matter how progressive a particular society is, and however sincerely it strives to do away with discrimination and class distinctions, its members can never attain equality in a personal sense. The reason for inequality within society, which will endure as long as men will roam upon the face of the globe, lies in the paradoxical nature of man, in his individuality and uniqueness. Inequality is perhaps the shibboleth of man, the most characteristic trait of him, the primark of distinction and differentiation from the subhuman world. As Chazal describes our sages, there are no two men, two people alike, both as to physical appearance, countenance, and as to their spiritual personality. Keshim shepart seyem mishunei, kar de seyem mishunes. Hence, successful man strong man emerges on the top, becomes king or ruler. Frustrated man, weak man, meek man turns into a subject. In other words, the fear of aloneness or loneliness and the quest for togetherness, coexistence and collaboration has precipitated the formation of power structures and power relationships. I just am departing from my text. Reading the Megillah last poem, I kept on thinking, I want to tell you, it did not interfere with my kavani. I kept on thinking how little human power structures have changed. Ahasuerus was a whimsical king, a very irritable individual, and quick in reaching decisions on the spur of the moment. Chazal, our rabbis, said sarcastically of him, he killed his beautiful queen, Vashti, upon the advice of his best friend, Memuchan. And later he killed his best friend upon the complaints of his beautiful queen, Esther. We enjoy, if we read properly, the element of comedy which is employed by the Megillah in portraying Ahasuerus. However, if our thoughts should cross approximately 24 centuries from Golot Babel, from the end of Golot Babel, to 1969, we realize that the same whimsicality or irritability on the part of an individual might result not merely in the execution of one person, of the prime minister, but in an ugly, bloody war. Or in a brutal invasion of a country like Czechoslovakia. Even, it might result even in the destruction of mankind. A capricious president, and every human being is capricious, in a moment of anger and wrath, may push the button and precipitate a nuclear confrontation. This depends just upon the whim of one man, of an individual. And the vainglorious president of France, in a moment of annoyance and anger, which were less justified than that of Ahasuerus, cut off the delivery of arms to a small nation, which is fighting for its very existence. I wonder indeed how much has been changed since the times of Ahasuerus. Yahadut has always been wary, very cautious, of political power structures, and displayed little tolerance for power concentrated in the hands of an individual. Of course, we were compelled to reconcile ourselves with historical realities, that no matter how imperfect government is, and no matter how undesirable the exercise of power on the part of an individual, be elected or be appointed, anarchy is still worse. And therefore,
We, I mean Yahadus, sanction the idea of the political community, the idea of a state, very reluctantly. If I were to characterize the attitude of Yahadus toward the political community, I would categorize it under the cliff of those precepts of which our rabbis, Chazal, said, "Le'dibro teiro kineged yetzer ro." Basically, the institutions are imperfect, but imperfect men must have imperfect institutions. You cannot create a perfect institution for imperfect men. And you know very well, you all probably say Perek summer during the summertime. I would even make a recommendation that Perek be studied in the yeshiva. Now, students may riot and go on strike in order to enforce this. Basically, Rabbi Hanina of Gana Kohanim meant to convey the same thought when he made his famous statement, "Mispalel b'shleima shel malchus," pray for the welfare of government, "Shilmola mero ish es chayim b'loei." The gist that he's saying is that while government is never perfect, but we must have order and a power structure, because without it, evil would triumph. Let us just give our attention to the precept of Minui Melech, because if we want halachically to find out about the attitude of Yahadus toward government in general, and monarch in particular, we have to investigate halachically. I mean, the mitzvah, the precept of Minui Melech, the appointment of a king. And by analyzing this precept, we'll arrive at certain conclusions which will be very relevant. Our subject matter. The commandment concerning the appointment of a king is not without certain reservations. I once heard from my father, Zechen Roch, that the validity of the commandment is dependent upon the fulfillment of two prerequisites, of two conditions. First, we are commanded or duty bound to appoint a king if there is need for him. If history actually dictates to us, and the disappointment and requires the setting up of monarchy. If, for instance, the defense of the king is indispensable for the defense of the people and of their land, then it's incumbent upon us to set up a monarchy and appoint a king. We should fight our battles, we should defend the land, and defend the physical and spiritual survival of the Jewish people. The very Braise, the famous Braise in Sanhedrin, that has identified the verse of Saint Tosim Alecha Melech, "Thou shalt appoint a king," as a positive precept, as binding, speaks as to other precepts which are tightly connected with that of the appointment of a king, as Minimach. Namely, whoever knows it, the to defeat Amalek, destruction of Amalek, and the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. We have to follow the appointment. In other words, the duty of the king is to provide the land and the people with maximum security. Otherwise, there would be no need for the setting up of a monarchy. Another situation may motivate or prompt the selection of a king, of a ruler, namely anarchy and the breakdown of law and order. The Bible in Shaftim, it means the book preceding Samuel, in which the appointment of the king came up, tells us and emphasizes and re-emphasizes, by Yom Mohain in those days, a melech be Israel, there was no king in Israel. Ishkol HaYosho Bein Aviyas, whatever a person likes to do, he was free to do. Why did the pasuk emphasize it many times? Because exactly this was the determining factor which made the appointment of the king mandatory. If law and order had prevailed without the king, there would be no need for it. The Rambam states in Miches Melochim, Perek Dalet, Miches Melochim, Halacha Hei, Sheimamlichim Melech Tchilo Elo La'aseis Mishpat Vilimchei Milchomeis Shenemar Vishafteinu Malkeinu Viyotso Lefaneinu Vinilcham Es Nilcham Esenu. The prime reason for appointing a king was that he implement the principles of justice and wage war as it is written, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. In a word, the power structure is justified if there is an external goal, a transient goal, which requires the setting up of such a structure. Only the attainment of the goal justifies the means. There is purposiveness to Malchut, and the purpose is not in the power structure itself, it's outside the power structure. It is transient. There is a teleology of kings, of royalty. Each king has his own telos, his own goal. Each king pursues his own objective. And the pursuit of the objective and the effort on the part of the king to realize the goal justifies kingdom, human kingdom, which is always imperfect. Each melech is charged with a specific task, according to the others. You don't appoint a melech just for the sake of dominion, or for the sake of ruling, or for the sake of exercising power, or wielding authority. Each melech, each king, was charged with a specific task. Each one pursued a definitive objective, whose implementation was the prime reason for the ascendancy of the king to Malchut. For instance, David's kingdom, the kingdom of the great King David, was wholly committed to the unification of the loosely federated tribes and the complete conquest of Eretz Israel, the timely subject, and the security of the people. If you study Shamush well, you'll find it between the lines. There was a telos to Malchus David. The telos was Ardut Israel, Kibush Haaretz, and of course the safety and the security of the people. Solomon's rule was concerned with the Binyan Beis Hamikdash, with the establishing of a spiritual, sacred center, the construction of the sanctuary. The Chizkiyahu's rule, according to our oral tradition, according to Teira Shel Harpeh, was dedicated to the perpetuation of Torah. According to Pirkei Rav Nosson, the founder of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the Knesset HaGdolah, was not Ezra, but Yechizkiyahu. It means, in other words, Malchut is justified if there is an assignment for Malchut. If there is no assignment, there is no need for Malchut. The second prerequisite is that the people request the appointment of the king. That the people recognize the need, that the people state the need and ask Bezdin or the prophet to appoint a king. No monarch should be imposed upon the people, no matter how great the need is. In Dvorim, when the Torah stated the precept of Malchus, it has qualified that the precept of Malchus is linked up with the request made by the people. The Amar Torah Simo Alai Melech Kechol Hageim Asher Svivei Soi, and you will make the request, or you will make the demand for the appointment of a king, Sein Tosim Alecha Melech. Then, and of course, people recognize the need, a great assignment to wait the king, but the people want him. Then same Tassim Alach HaMalach. Then Bezdin is duty bound to comply with the request and appoint the king. If the people do not utter such a wish, Bezdin has no right to establish a monarchy. The suggestion of appointing a king must come from the people, and only then, in compliance with their will, Bezdin is obligated to select a monarch, is stated almost unequivocally by the Rambam. Rambam, referring to a minor of Rabbi Neroi in Sanhedrin, which I cannot analyze now, says as follows: Mi'acher sha'omas melech mitzvah לומר לרוצה הקודש ברוך הוא כששואלו מלך משמואל לפי ששואלו בתרומס ולשואלו לקיים המצווה אלו מפני שקוצו בשמואל הנביא שנאמר לאיסחו מועצו כי אם איסי. I'll translate it. Seeing that the setting up of the king was a commandment, why did the Holy One look with disfavor upon the request made by the people of Samuel for a king? Because they asked in a quarrelous spirit, their request was prompted not by the desire to fulfill a precept, but by a desire to rid themselves of Samuel, the prophet. As it is written, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me. I believe that the question must be asked immediately. The question rises immediately, and it's an obvious question. Why should the way in which the request was made affect the validity or the binding character of the precept of appointing a king? Let us assume that the request was not phrased in proper and intelligent language. And that, and the motive was the wrong one. There was still no reason for Shmuel or Kodesh Baruch Hu Kali Yochel to look with disfavor upon the appointment of a king, which constitutes a basic precept, a mitzvah min ha'Torah. The wrong motivation never nullifies the worth of the act, of a mitzvah deed. A false approach must not render a deserving, noble act null and void. You know all the Memre d'Rav, Rav saying, Leilam Yassi Godom Beteiro B'mitzvahs, Shalei Lishmo, Metech Shalei Lishmo, Bo Lishmo. Why did a Kodesh Baruch Hu classify their petition for a king wrong and sinful, equating it with rebellion against God's authority? Le'ifchom ha'asu, ki'im isi. Of course, the only logical conclusion to be derived from my mind is, from this quotation from the Rambam, is that the request for a king is of central significance, since it is the source of the norm, since it legitimizes the power structure created by the appointment, since the request is a conditio sine qua non for the fulfillment or implementation of the mitzvah of Minyan Melech, of appointing a king. Therefore, it is necessary that the request be formulated in compliance with the halachah. And if the request is not phrased in the proper language and is motivated by a wrong desire, it fails to produce results. And the appointment of a king is not mandatory. And whenever the appointment of a king is not obligatory or mandatory, it is sinful to appoint a king. The reason for the reluctance on the part of Yahadis to set up permanent power structures, because a monarchy is a permanent power structure, such as monarchy, is due to two motives. First, as the old saying goes, power corrupts. Abuse of power is inevitable. The greatest of all rulers, of all kings, the most ideal charismatic leader, is bound willingly to step over the boundary of legitimate authority and engage in some kind of tyranny, arbitrary decisions, unfair practices. Power, this was the opinion of Yahadis, contrary to the popular opinion, limits the freedom of the man of power. The loss of freedom on the part of the man of power is proportionate to the amount of power with which he was endowed and equipped. The more authority the people bestow upon him, the more of his freedom is taken away. The more the number of options which he has at his disposal is limited. Just I'll quote one passage. When Saul came there, we just read it last Shabbos, but
Shabbat
Shabbat Zohar. Then Saul came back from Amalek, bringing along Agag and some cattle and some sheep. And Shmuel asked him why he violated the word of God. Why he didn't comply with the instructions he gave him. So Shmuel had one excuse. And this excuse was fatal. This excuse, I'm afraid, sealed Shmuel's destiny. So tries to justify his action vis-à-vis Amalek when Samuel rebuked him. But the people took of the spoil. I didn't take. The people took of the spoil. And the word of Yahmelon should be underlined. I didn't take. The people took of the spoil of the sheep and the oxen. I could not stop them. I had to listen to and reckon with the crowd. A king cannot get along without the crowd. The ruler must read the mind of the gullible and very excitable crowd. And when the ruler must be concerned with the crowd, he cannot exercise legitimate authority, a legitimate power. But this reason is basically of secondary nature. This is not the main reason why Yahadus was so reluctant and so unwilling to accept power structures. Over his fellow man. Certainly, Yahadu says, the ruler is capable, otherwise he wouldn't be a ruler. Brilliant, God blessed him with a sense of leadership and an inspiring personality. Certainly, those who are subordinate to him are dull, meek, and in need of guidance. So it's quite natural that one rules and the other one is being ruled. But Yahadus asks, but does intellectual superiority justify the exercise of power? Do personal traits, no matter how relevant, grant the person the right to order, to instruct, and to dominate? And in general, Yahadus never measured the worth of the human personality by the yardstick of his creative talents. Never. Yahadus many times has repeated many times, a contrite heart is more cherished by the Almighty than a keen mind. And a person modest and humble because circumstances prevented him from actualizing the human potential which God implanted in him is more acceptable to the Almighty than a person vain, proud, because he was lucky and circumstances favored him and gave him the opportunity to achieve fame and take advantage of every talent God invested him with. Moreover, Mary has not been invited to share the attribute of Melucho HaMemshala. We say, Amlucho HaMemshala, kingdom and might belongs exclusively to the Eternal. True, many divine potencies are accessible to man. The Almighty asks of man quite often to join him and paradoxically to be like him. Moreover, it is God's will that men imitate him, that men follow in his ways, that men attempt to be divine, to participate in the infinite moral acting on the part of the Almighty. Volachta bedrochov, more pungent is the expression, ve'anveyu ani vehu, I like him, mahu chanun, he is merciful, I want to be merciful as well. Mahu rachum, he is charitable and kind, I want to be charitable and kind as well. And so forth on. Yet, power is an exception to the rule of Allah. You don't say, he is mighty, I also want to be mighty. Power is an exclusive divine potency to which man has no access. Melech Elyon dislikes very much Melech Evyon if the latter begins to take himself seriously. The quest for power basically precipitated the first sin on the part of man. The serpent took advantage of the human urge to rule, to dominate, to be mighty, to emerge victorious from every engagement, to legislate his own laws, etc., and persuaded Eve to sin by telling her that through eating from the tree of knowledge, she will realize her ambition, she'll become powerful. Ve'yishem kelekim yedi tevara. And Jihadus was not only wary and cautious with regard to the political community, the so-called executive branch of power, or even the legislative branch of power, but also very cautious with reference to the judicial community, to the judicial branch of government. And again, Jihadus has always been confronted with an antinomy implied in the very core of power exercise and power structure, including the judicial power structure. On one hand, Jihadus was convinced that due to the human situation, or to a human situation, when one cannot dispense with those structures. On the other hand, he has consistently argued that man is not entitled to sit in judgment over his fellow man. Only God has a right to judge people. Elikim nitzav v'adaskei v'kerev elikim yishbeit. That's why Yehadus complicated very much. Sometimes we marvel at the difficulties and complexities that Yehadus has introduced in the judicial process. It has almost eliminated not only bodily punishment. We have many chayvim, yes, but we have executed very few in our history. We have many chayvim malkes, but we have implemented this penalty very rarely. It has eliminated not only bodily punishment, but also monetary fines, like knas. Nowadays, you know, in an adonim diniknosis, because we lack smicha, we lack the authority. Even as regards trivial, everyday litigation, in civil matters, Yehadus has almost with fear and foreboding warned the Dayan, the justice, who is authorized to resolve the controversy, that he is engaged in something awesome and dreadful, and that in case he should err or even falter in the execution of justice, his sin will be unpardonable. Leilam yire dayan atznei ki lecherev munachas leal tzavorei v'genim psucholei metachtov v'yeda es mihudon v'lifnei mihudon. I'm reading my mind, the Rambam. Lihipum miyosig lihipora memenu im nota mekav emes shnemar lekim nitzov badas keilu v'eimer ריומא תמיסים קרים אדם תשפטו כלא דשם. At all times the judge should think of himself as if a sword were suspended over his head and gehenim gaping under him. He should know who is judging, whom he is judging, and before whom he is judging, and who will call him to account if he deviates from the line of truth. As it is written, God standeth in the congregation of God, in the midst of the judges. And it's also written, consider what you do, for you judge not for man, but for the Lord. Chronicles 19:6. This is more or less the general attitude of Yehadus. Of course, I could quote many sources substantiating and confirming, I mean, my interpretation. But there's no need for it. But Malchus signifies not only a concrete power structure, a political institution, or a political community, like kingdom, government, state, but also a great metaphysical idea. Malchus, in its metaphysical context, turns into a glorious vision which the covenantal community has beheld and has been fascinated with since the dawn of its millennial history. Malchus is a metaphysical idea turns into a great ethical norm, which is how to achieve the ultimate objective in Yehadus. Within the metaphysical frame of reference, Malchus is not the prerogative of an individual, or of a single person, of a clan or a dynasty. Within the metaphysical frame of reference, Malchus has been bestowed upon men in general. On that mysterious Friday, when God fashioned him out of dust and made him an individual being, unique and singular, who cannot be replaced, for whom there is no substitute. Later, men lost Malchus, according to Chazal, when he sinned. And God wants his covenantal community, his people, to restore the quality of Malchus to its members. So basically, the potential of Malchus has been implanted in every Jew. The question is how to implement it, how to realize it. Of course, in order to realize it, we have got to understand what it is, what it stands for, what it requires of man. How does Malchus, as a moral metaphysical idea, express itself? How does it express itself? Again, we must consult the halacha. We stated, and we also tried to prove, that Malchus, as a legitimate political structure, requires an objective. It tells us an assignment. Whenever there is urgent need for the setting up of such an institution, it's incumbent upon us to implement the precept of appointing a king. In other words, Malchus is significant whenever history burdens this institution with a specific mission. As I said before, the power structure is of a teleological nature. In a word, Malchus equals assignment awareness. The awareness that one has an assignment to implement and to carry out. The equation is, of course, like many other equations, reversible. We may say, therefore, an assignment awareness equals Malchus. Who is king? Who is king in a metaphysical sense? Whoever feels committed. Whoever feels committed to the achievement of a great goal, to the realization of an objective. Who is a king? Whoever carries a load. It's very strange that in Hebrew, a load master is, of course, is to be understood in physical sense and also in a spiritual sense. Master is also prophecy. The prophet is loaded for burden. He is dedicated. He is committed. He is not free. Malchus takes away freedom, I told you before. But by taking away freedom, one's personality is being enhanced. Who is king? Whoever is burdened with a task. Who is king? Whoever has a concern for something. And he is ready, to implement his assignment. And here, I said it many times, I don't know whether I ever spoke to you about it. Here, Yehadus comes in with its doctrine of assignment. And it's a very important doctrine. Not only important theoretically, philosophically, it's important in practical terms, too. Each man was created in order to carry out a certain task. He was created at a certain time, in a certain place, in a certain society. He was born into a certain family. Because all those circumstances will make it possible for him to implement his tasks. The fact that I wasn't born a century ago is because a century ago I couldn't carry out my task. I can't. That's what they say, Elikai, Achilene Tzavi. I wasn't created 100 years ago, I wasn't created 200 years ago, I was not created 300 years ago, I was not created during, in course of countless centuries, in many millennia. You know why? In any case, because I was not worthy of being created, because I had an assignment. Had I been created, I wouldn't have had an assignment. Each man was created in order to carry out a certain task. Each individual was entrusted a specific assignment, which he must implement no matter how difficult and no matter how embarrassing sometimes the implementation is. It is not just incidental that in Hebrew we do not distinguish between wage and reward, between contracted and non-contracted compensation the way we do in other languages. And you see, in English, wage means if you pay a laborer or a hireling whom you contracted to perform a certain task for you. Then you say reward, it means a gratuitous one. You give him because he's meritorious, but there is no obligation and no commitment on your part to reward him. If you do reward him, it's a voluntary act on your part. It's generosity. Yahadu says not two words. The biblical and Talmudic Hebrew, in the biblical and the Talmudic Hebrew, the noun sochor has the connotation of reward as well as of wage. The noun sochor has a dual connotation, wage and reward. Yahadus has apparently considered the good bestowed upon man for a meritorious life as an earned wage, not as a gratuitous reward. Because man, according to Yahadus, is under contractual obligation to his employer, who happens to be the Almighty. He is actually a hireling who was contracted to perform a specific task, and who, upon completing his assignment, he may lay claim to well-earned compensation. And it is not, and there is nothing new in what I'm saying. It's a verse in Yov. Im harutzim yomov mispo, chadosho vitoch, chukov asiso, v'leyare, sheme olo v'yardal, ad yotze kesocha. Seeing his days are determined, the number of his months are with thee, and thou hast appointed his bound that he cannot pass. If you look away from him, that he may rest till he shall accomplish as a hireling his day. The life of man is like a day which is being completed by the hireling. Man is a sachir. Of course, you know very well that the assignment theory doctrine has been spelled out in unmistakable terms, unequivocal, unmistakable terms, in what book? In Tanakh. Just right. In what book in Tanakh? The assignment doctrine. Man is created and charged with an assignment. And all he has to do is to carry out his task. In what book? Just right. In what book? Jaina. Yes, of course. Jaina, yes. But Jaina, you speak of a prophet. Nevuah. Of course, Nevuah is also an assignment. It's a load placed upon the person. It's a burden. But I believe there's another book. We just read it. In the Megillah. In the Megillah. Isn't it? And I believe that the assignment doctrine is the focal theme of the Megillah. Let me read a pasuk. It's one pasuk. Al tidame b'nafshech limolad beis hamelech mikol hayehudim k'machri shtachrishi b'eis hazeis revach v'atzolo yamid layehudim imokim acher v'at v'eis avich tevedu u'mi yedea. I'm emphasizing the words im lo'eis kazeis yigat l'malchus. Who would someone volunteer to translate these words? Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. If thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then will relief and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house will perish. And who knows whether thou art not come to royal estate for such a time as this. basically what Mordechai said is simply that there is an assignment for each individual. And he reminded Esther of the assignment which was entrusted to her and of the summons, of the stark of summons, which she has to answer. And of the historical challenge which she has to accept and to meet. Basically, Mordechai analyzed here and formulated three ideas within the assignment doctrine. The assignment doctrine consists of three basic thoughts. First, each individual is assigned a task which he must implement. The assignment never transcends one's ability. The individual is never required to do something that is above and beyond his reach. And as far as Esther is concerned, Mordechai said, Esther was favored by the Almighty with beauty, an irresistible charm, and at the same time, charged with the mission of saving her people. It is strange. The mission of saving the people was placed squarely upon the athletic, strong shoulders of David and his commander-in-chief, Yoav. And now, the same mission was placed upon the frail soldiers of a delicate and lonely woman who continuously lived in the shadow of rejection and death. She was burdened with the same mission with which the kingdom of David was charged, to save the people and to defeat a formidable enemy and to protect the Jewish community from annihilation. And if you will ask me now, what is our assignment in these days? What is the assignment of the Jewish community in 1969? Of course, very hard to guess. Each one has an assignment which is known only to God Almighty, but sometimes we may find out. We may explore history a bit and somehow come across the assignment. What is the assignment with which we are charged now? Everyone, every Jew, man or woman. I believe the assignment is a double one. First, to safeguard and protect the Jew physically, to defend the physical survival of the Jew. First of all, in Eretz Israel, it is a daily problem, because it's not a question in Eretz Israel about a state. This is already a minor problem. This is already a secondary or a third problem. The Arabs don't want to annihilate the state. They simply want to annihilate the Jewish community as such. Because we live in a post-Hitlerian era. And the Jewish enemy is very sophisticated now. In the Middle Ages and in modern times, the enemy of the Jew tried to persecute the Jew, to legislate restrictive laws, to make his life hard, to lock him up in the ghetto, to take away his franchise, his liberties. But now the enemy of the Jew is sophisticated. He's a liberal. He's a democrat. All he wants is to kill the Jew. And what do you think? If the Arabs had won Rahman al-Islam, if the Arabs had won the war in 1967, what would have happened to the Jewish population? He's entrusted not only to the Israelis, but us as well. And I don't mean as far as extending help to Israel is concerned, but I mean even in the diaspora, we should be on the alert. Look out for any manifestation of anti-Semitism, for any leaflet, for any song, for any poem on the radio. And let not liberals
or intellectual stallion. It is irrelevant. It is kid stuff. I lived in Germany during the ascendancy of Hitler to power, and I heard the same song in Germany when the Hitler brigade used to march from Kurfürstendamm and sing the Horst Wessel song. So the intellectuals laughed. They joked. Oh, it's nothing. But apparently, kid stuff has resulted in the crematorium Majdanek and the guest chambers of Majdanek. Look out for it! And not politicians. Mayor or governor or congressman or senator should be tolerated if he tolerates anti-Semitic literature or statements in as city employees or city appointees. Secondly, this is the assignment which resembles the task with which Mordechai charged Esther. Second, this is just as important as the first assignment. We must defend the spiritual identity of the Jew in the diaspora, and as well as America, against assimilationism, against disintegration, and also against apostasy, against Shmatz. Don't dismiss this problem. Now, this is the first element of the doctrine of assignment which Mordechai formulated is simply that each individual is entrusted with a task and which he must implement at all costs. Second, what is the second thought? The second element of the doctrine of assignment, the way Mordechai has defined and formulated it. In case of human failure and human betrayal and human indifference, God's will be done anyway. The assignment will be carried out, if not by the individual, by someone else. And the third element, the individual who did not answer the call of history and did not respond to the challenge and did not carry out his assignment is a traitor and his sin is unpardonable. Now, Malchut, in order to be a Malach, to acquire not a kingdom, there's no need to acquire a kingdom, but kingship. To acquire not a Meluche, but Malchut, one must be aware of the assignment, of that man is a committed being, not a free being. But Malchut contains another dimension. Namely that of a not an existence. I won't explain. Let me explain it by introducing a Kabbalistic equation. To the ubiquitous presence of God within the world. Not outside, but within the world. Within the natural cosmic order or drama. When we mention or we say we pronounce the name of the Holy One, Cain, we refer to his remoteness, transcendence, beyond the fringes and the outskirts of the universe, and above the here and now reality. Cain is Tapir, the Shaf Rechavion. However, when we say Shino, we address ourselves to God, who has never been distant from us, who stands next to us or to me, who trails behind me and walks in front of me.
עד השם צירי על יד ימיני. To God with whom I converse, to whom I pray and cling in times of distress, to whom I sing hymn of praise when destiny is good to me, in whom I confide, in whom I find comfort and solace and peace of mind and serenity. In short, Shina denotes an open, communicative, divine presence, a nearness which spans the gap separating creator from creature. You know very well that Shina is formed of the verb Shochin. What does Shochin mean? To abide, to be present, to reside. You know what Shochin in Hebrew means? A neighbor. However, the term Shechina signifies not only immanence and proximity in a communicative sense, but also in a sympathetic sense. Shechina is the mother, Matronusa, who is kind and understanding, and displays unlimited tolerance and patience for her imperfect child. And that imperfect child happens to be man himself in all his majesty and glory. Forgiving his shortcomings, overlooking his errors, and not minding his nonsensical insolence and impudence. Patiently, she waits for her child to come back, to regret, to confess, and to amend his ways. She never deserts her child. She never deserts a sinner. Ani ad Hashem, Asheichin itom, Beteich tumeseyem. I am God, who reside in the midst of their defiled existence. In a word, Shechina not only communicates with man, but also has compassion for man. She shares his troubles, his cares, his tragic experiences, and failures for which he himself is responsible. This man, Shiradam, Mitzpahir, the Mishnah says in Zaharan, Shechina Ma'emeres, if a man is in trouble, face that verse, what does Shechina say? Kilani Meritrei, Kilani Mereshi. I have pain in my heart, I have pain in my head. The same is true, applies to the individual who wants to achieve kingship, because according to Kabbalah, Shechina equals Malchus. Shechina is identical with Malchus. So what is Malchus? What is kingship? How does one achieve kingship? How does one realize the idea of kingship? By having an open existence. An open existence is a royal existence. The king resides in the midst of the people. It's quite interesting that the king in Israel was always close to his subjects, accessible to them. Widow, orphan, if you read it now, widow, orphan, woodchopper, water thrower, vagabond, stranger and old-timer, sinner and saint, thief and merchant, everybody, and everyone could approach the king to complain for him and to demand justice and to ask for help. I'll just quote to Psukim. Then came there, it means before the king Solomon, two women that were harlots unto the king and stood before him. Who admitted them? What is the answer? There was no need for anybody to admit them. They just opened the door and walked in.
And as the king of Israel was passing by upon the wall, there cried a woman unto him, saying, Help, my lord, my king.
Such absurd rules as about which we read in the Megillah last week, Kiholish Misho, Ashoyoga Nochatzer Apnis, Ashoyi Koi, Achazdasin Onis, מלבד אשר יש את פריאנה להחשב מתחזור וחויר that appearing before the king in a courtyard without invitation from the king there is only one law for him that he be put to death such absurd rules have never existed in the annals of Yahadun anybody could knock on the door of the king and come in because anybody can knock on the door of the king Melech Malchei Hamlochim come in And in the accessibility of the Melech Malchei Hamlochim lies the mystery of Tefillah. What is Tefillah? I can open the door and walk in and appear before the throne of the Almighty and complain and to cry and to thank and to demand and to request and to beg. In a word, men who aspire to kingship must open up his existence, be communicated, accessible, and be capable of coordinating his basic needs with the needs of others. When I say an open existence, please don't make any mistake. I do not mean the cultivation of sociability or gregarism. An open existence can be achieved by the introvert or even the introspective personality. Sociability, gregariousness are not necessarily the traits of existential openness. What I want to express for this term is that men while living, working, suffering, rejoicing, and moving along an endless trail of his own, which no one else will ever cross, must always remember that in spite of the fact that he is a singular being, he is not the only one, and he is not a single being. That God concern encompasses not only him, but countless individuals like him, who also wander, each one along his own trail. While Malchus, in general historical terms, precipitates separation of the king from the people, his elevation other than an existential exclusiveness by moving the king from the periphery, from the crowd, to the center, Yahad Malchus in Yahadus, according to our view, means integration of the individual in the community and existential all-inclusiveness and openness. And let me tell you something, it is not just pseudo-philosophy that I tell you now. It's more than it. It has practical relevance. Malchus within Yahadus means the acceptance of the Klal Yisrael as such. Good or bad. Whether the Klal Yisrael consists of sinners or saints, we must accept the Klal Yisrael as it is. And open up our existence to the Klal Yisrael. Any act of dividing the Klal Yisrael, any act of separating people, of creating this sectarian philosophy, any act of which is out to promote and cultivate isolationism, any moral religious egocentrism and self-righteousness violates the principle of existential opportunity.
Who is the king?
The Jew is who has offered himself up. He offered himself up to the crown Israel. And embraces the entire crown Israel. Without excluding anybody. The king's existential openness is both of a communicative as well as a sympathetic nature.
That's what I call communicative existential openness.
When I remember that God's concern embraces everybody. But there is also, I mean, the Shekhinah, as I said before, not only communicates with man, but suffers with him, has compassion with him, participates in his travail, in troubles. So must the king's existence be an open one, not only in a communicative sense, but also in a sympathetic sense. The Rambam, speaking of the king, uses a very strange term, not term, phrase. Mipnei shelibei leiv kol Yisrael. The heart of the king is the heart of the king. Malchus requires of man not only to be aware of the existence of Adam, but to feel, but also to feel, to experience their existence. As if it were his own. In other words, Malchus requires of man to join and fit together concerns, wishes, dreams, and particularly pain and suffering. As long as I'm just cognizant of the existence of fellow man, I would just categorize as Reya. You know what Reya in Hebrew is? Reyayim? Ki sode di kerem Reyacho? Ki yigach sheir ish sheir Reyu? Reya, a comrade, an acquaintance, a neighbor, sometimes a good one, sometimes a better one. Because the Pesach also says, ki yokum yishal Reyu lehor vidomo. One should conspire to kill his Reya, his comrade. Means it was a Reya yesteryear was a Reya, but now it's an enemy of mine. Of course, in the political community, I mean, these changes take place. I'm just a Reya, a neighbor. The very instant, I begin to perceive him, not to know him, but to perceive him, to feel his existence. Experience his joys and frustrations, agony and hope. I turn from a Reya into what? Into a brother. Into Och. This higher degree of coexistence, of interrelatedness and companionship. A brother? What does brotherliness mean? Existential unity. One destiny. One life, basically. One memory. The precept of Tzedakah in Yahadus, of Tzedakah in Chesed, is nurtured by the doctrine of sympathetic openness, or a sympathetic open existence, or by brotherliness. While speaking of charity and of tzedakah, the Torah constantly employs, without a single exception, constantly employs the term och, not reya. Ki yomu chachicho. Never has the parent used the term Reya. Because Reya might You see, when the Torah speaks about civil law, not to inflict harm on someone, so it employs the term rech. The fact that it is my neighbor imposes a duty and obligation upon me, I should respect his property, respect his rights, and not inflict, and I must not inflict any harm or damage on him. I have damage on him. But this does not entitle the rech to my support, that I should share his troubles and be helpful to him in times of need. For that, the bond of Rea is too weak. You need a stronger bond, that of our father.
Maimonides and Rambam emphasized the element of brotherliness in conjunction with his toke. One is obligated to help and to share with the unfortunate one, his woes and misery.
Because in tzedakah is not, I want you to say, halachically, tzedakah does not consist exclusively of extending material help, sharing experiences, and displaying sympathy and compassion is a part of mitzvah tzedakah. At times, it's more relevant and more important than the material help I extend to someone else.
At this juncture,
a new concept of power in Yahadus emerges.
We said before that the Torah was very reluctant about sanctioning power and promoting unlimited power. It has just reconciled itself with historical realities, nothing else. But the Torah considered power structures as imperfect. But there is one power structure, whether you may call it, we should call it power structure or not, it's a different problem, but there is one form of power of authority which the Torah sanctioned, not only sanctioned, recommended and stressed the importance of it. There is one form of power or authority which Yadus is sanctioned wholeheartedly, namely the authority exercised by the teacher over his people. The relationship between Rav and Talmid, between teacher and pupil, or may I use another word, master and disciple. The commanding influence of the master over his disciple was accepted by the Torah without any qualifications or reservations. In fact, the spiritual authority is quite often superior to political power. More, it endures longer and is almost all-inclusive. At times, spiritual authority borders on the ultimate. On blind obedience. Of course, I may make the following remark. This kind of power may sometimes be misused and abused by unscrupulous teachers. Remember that. And please don't suspect me that I am preaching a doctrine which is convenient for me, which is relevant to me. But this is a central thought in Yahadus. But of course, the teacher should be ideal. The impact, for instance, that the Baal Shem Tov had upon his disciples and through them on the lives of hundreds of thousands of Jews throughout two centuries can hardly be matched by any ruler in the history of the political community. The same is true, I could mention many names, but the same is true of the Gaon of Vilna. The latter, I mention him because the latter was a contemporary of Napoleon, was just a bit older, who is being considered as the prototype of
of the man of power, as the prototype of the charismatic leader, warlord, legislator, and king.
Yet the God's posthumous authority outlived that of Napoleon and many others.
While the Hadith has been perturbed about political power in a strive to limit its exercise as much as possible, he did encourage his disciple to give boundless respect to his teacher, the Talmud to the Rav, to listen to him, and to fulfill his wishes.
And I have to quote many Maimonides and Chazal in order to substantiate that statement. What do you say? Could someone suggest just one Maimonides and Chazal, which will suffice, I mean, to cringe it up.
Es hat schon mir der Khatira. Der Rabbi ist Talmid Chachamim. And Pesach says Talmid Chachamim is to be interpreted in terms teachers. Rabbi Muvek, his grand teacher, who trained him.
Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God. His precept includes also the norm to fear and respect scholars and teachers.
God is not ready to share his authority and power with the king, with the political community. However, he is willing to share his authority, his power, with the spiritual community and with the teachers. Why? If I'm Rukhov and I'm Shala, as jealously being guarded for God, why did Yahadu surrender to the teacher? Yahadu refused to surrender to the king, to the greatest of all kings, but did surrender to the teacher, to the Rav. Two reasons lie at the root of the Judaic glorification and idealization of the teacher of the Rav. First, the authority of the Rav is not imposed upon the people. No political instrument is used. No coercive action is undertaken to foist the authority of the Rav upon the people. The Talmid, of his own free will, yields to the authority of the teacher. He joyfully submits to his way of thinking. At times, the teacher feels embarrassed by the deference of the pupil and by the bad habit to imitate the teacher. At times, while political authority of the king is nurtured by fear, spiritual authority of the Rav is rooted in deep affection and respect. Teacher, yes, teacher is a master, like the king is a master. But the mastery of the teacher does not result in slavery of the people, but in his freedom. The mastery of the king precipitates slavery of his subjects. Second reason why Yahadus has glorified the teacher, idealized him, and God is ready to share his authority, his power, with the teacher. Authority and ownership are identical concepts. Authority is vested in whom? In the owner, who can dispose or use his property in any arbitrary fashion or manner. I can break it up, I can destroy it, I can give it away, I can take it away. I have full unlimited authority over my property.
the head of the political community.
You haven't just denied authority to the head of the political community for a simple reason. Because the head, the king, does not own his subjects. They don't belong to him. They are his equals in the eyes of Yahadus. Whom he has no right to rule.
God's authority is boundless. You know why?
Because he is the maker of all things. That's why he rules all things.
He is the king of unlimited authority
because he is the creator of many things, of the endless and vast universe.
But the Shemites,
however, in a very strange way, has always looked upon the teacher, if not as upon a creator, ex nihilo, a human being cannot create ex nihilo, then at least as upon a fashioner, an artisan, who takes primordial metal and impresses upon it, a form upon it, shapes something amorphous into something beautiful and fascinating.
And the Hadith says, the subject does not belong to the king, but the pupil belongs to the teacher. Because the latter trained him and enlightened him, sensitized his heart, and molded his personality, and brought out the noblest and the finest and the best. And I want to add something. The authority of the parent, according to Yahadus, is rooted in the authority of the teacher. The parent is a teacher, and perhaps the most outstanding teacher of the child. And that's why the child is supposed to have partners who share the child. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Holy Living.
Yahadus considers Talmud Torah or Limud Torah, teachings of Torah, as creative work and as a reflex of the infinite process of creation initiated by God at the dawn of history, and which has never come to a close. God summons men to participate in this great, wondrous drama of creation. The teacher, the Rav, answers the call and joins the Creator. Hence he has a share in the student. He owns him because he is responsible for everything the student stands for. And it is self-evident that with ownership comes authority. Ech ha-nefesh asher osu v'choron. I don't have to reach out to her. The souls which they made the horn. How can you make a soul? Only God can make a soul. How could Abraham and Sarah make souls, create souls? So Chazal says, Milam etri avron etanya esra anoshim. Abraham made his souls because he enlightened and taught them. The Sarah has Sanoshim. Likewise, did Sarah participate in the creative gesture because she taught and enlightened people. As a matter of fact, the creative, didactic gesture, the educational gesture of teaching consists in the opening up of one's systems. It's not a mechanical process. It's more a metaphysical process. And I've been a teacher for many, many years, 28 years. That teacher, a good teacher, but I've been a teacher. I tried out. It's very hard to get rid of me when I come into the class.
It does not consist in mechanical passing on of information.
Because if it's just one who passes on information, hands down information, he's a very poor teacher. I wouldn't hire him as a Rosh Yeshiva if I were the boss. It consists in a metaphysical, or I would say metapersonal, process or gesture of opening up one's existence, of letting the student share in the great spiritual treasures stored up in the depth and the recesses of the teacher. One cannot teach unless he tears down all barriers separating individual from each other, unless he is ready to establish an existential community.
It's full realization. No wonder that Chazal spoke of Rabbonon, Man Malchim, who are the king, Rabbonon. Not because they were very wealthy. You know, Chachmei Chazal knew of the poverty in which, our scholars found themselves. The Malki Rabbanon, because they exercise authority which is not just love. As a matter of fact, let me come back to the political community. The glorious tradition of Malchus Beis David, which is supposed to find its culmination in the King Messiah. Of course, this is the principal tenet of our creedal. Rests not upon the king as the head of a political community, but upon the king teacher doctrine. Who is the Messiah? A politically powerful monarch? Certainly not. Who is he? A one whose authority was established by force? Certainly not. No. Who is he? The Messiah is the great wondrous teacher, prophet who will teach, instruct, enlighten, and by so doing, redeem the world. I don't have to quote the Rambam for that. The Rambam is very explicit. Mipnei she'isei ha-melech, the Rambam says in Yuchishtiwa, she'yah meid mizer ha-dolit, balchoch mo yiye yisa mishreinei, v'novi godin hu korev le-Moshe, Rabbeinu, ulefikach ilah meid es kolom, ויירי דרך עד השם, ויובאו כל הגויים לשומי, שמן הרי דם דן סלמון, and will be a great prophet approach all of the Jewish people, and instruct them in the ways of God, and all nations will come to hear him, as it is said, and at the end of days, it shall come to pass, that the mount of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains, and as his ways, and will walk in his path. The Rambam couldn't have said it in more explicit terms. That the ideal of Moses is the synthesis or the merger of king teacher. And please, those who take philosophy and take Plato, please don't confuse this theory, this Plato theory of the state. There's no common denominator. Malchut, I repeat, Malchut achieves its complete realization in the teacher-king union. Not teacher's union, but teacher-king union. And let me just give you one example. We have a rule in Talmud. Meshe Rabbeinu Melech Hoyo. Meshe Rabbeinu was a king. Halachically.
question. There is a pasuk, basically. Of course, a pasuk could be interpreted in two ways, but a medrash interprets a pasuk with reference to Moshe. Vahi b'shurun melech b'sasev roshom yachad shifti Yisrael. Why was Moses a king? And if Moses was a king, he was the greatest of all kings in our history. Why was he a king? Because he was the greatest teacher the Jews ever had. And the greatest teacher is ipso facto the greatest king. As a matter of fact, when the Gemara in Brachos portrays David as a Rosh Yeshiva, David is a Rosh rendering halachic decisions, David rising at 12 o'clock to study Torah, David studying with Mephibosheth. It's actually what the Gemara says is taken from what Psalm, from Tzman Yate. Why did the Gemara portray David as the great Talmid Chacham, the great scholar, the teacher? Because without it, he wouldn't have been the great king. If David was a great king, it's only because he was a great teacher. And his objective was not politics, but scholarship. Now let me add something else. Yet no matter how exalted the idea of Malchus is, and exalted it is indeed, Malchus must be dovetailed to another idea, namely that of Kedusha or Malchus. Of course, Malchus, when realized, is a grand experience. It closed up. What happens when Malchus is realized? What happens to the person who achieves kingship? It closed up, sensed in, self-oriented, ego-conscious, and within-minded individual, opusat, toward the outside. Tells down no senses. Orientations, trends, and with a gesture of magnanimity, spreads out his arms to embrace Claudius. Yet, in spite of the grandeur of Malchus, the realization is not complete. If Malchus does not meet Kedusha and merge his Kedusha. But what does it mean? How does Malchus merge his Kedusha? We have it in Ishtabach, Kedusha and Malchus. Where is it? The link between Malchus and Kedusha? What does the Melech have to do in order to acquire Kedusha? He's aware of his assignment. He tries to meet the challenge of history, to answer the summons of history, of the hour, of the historical hour. He opened up his existence. He tore down all barriers. He shed his selfishness, his egocentrism. He understands that. He understands everybody and sympathizes with everybody. He is a teacher, a great teacher. So what else does he have to do? In order to achieve the pinnacle of Malchus, the apex of Malchus, where Malchus and Kedusha merge, they tell me one idea, which is the ultimate goal of every Jew, which is the final destination rather, of every man. What is the Melech supposed to do? Let me try to answer this question. As we stated before, just a while ago, Moses was a king. He was, as I said, the greatest of all kings. Because he was the greatest of all teachers. The greatest of all prophets. I would like to ask you one question. When did Moses become a king? Could you give me the date? When was the majestic crown of Moses placed squarely by the Almighty upon Moses' head? Of course, the answer is simple. When he stood before God on Mount Sinai. Not before that. How do I know it? How do you know that the crown was placed upon Moses' head when he stood before his master on Mount Sinai? We say it every Shabbos. Klil tiferes bereshin osatalei v'omdei lefonecho al har Sinai. Moses rejoiced at the destiny bestowed upon him when thou didst call him thy faithful servant, placing on his head a crown of glory as he stood before thee on Mount Sinai. Means Moses was crowned as king on Mount Sinai. It's quite logical. Now let me ask you another question. Moses stood before the Almighty, before the Lord, at the top of the mount three times, at least two times. But at least two times. When was he crowned? The first time or the last time? At the time of the first Matan Torah or at the time of the second Matan Torah? What do you say? Correct. We all know the answer. He was crowned when he stood before his master on the Mount Sinai, for the last time, before the master of God has delivered to him the Shteluchei Savonim, the two tablets of stone, the so-called Luchot Shniyot, the second Luchot. We read just yesterday that before Moses departed from Har Sinai, God made Moses' face radiate. Only then was Moses appointed, anointed, and crowned as king by God, by the Almighty. And it came to pass, when Moses came down from the mount for the last time, that Moses knew not that the skin of his face sent forth beams. Again, a third question rises. Why was he elevated to the stature of a king only at the time of the second Matan Torah, using the Jewish calendar, our calendar, on Yom Kippur? Why wasn't he elevated to kingdom on Shavuos at the time of the first time? When he confronted the Almighty for the first time. What happened during that destiny-charged period separating the second Matan Torah from the first Matan Torah that promoted Moses to king, to kingdom, to kingship? What happened? What event? You cannot say the confrontation is the Lord, because the confrontation took place the first time as well as the second time. There's no reason to consider the second time superior to the first time. You certainly know one episode took place. Shvirat HaLuchos. The Luchos of our Shatter. Nothing else. Shvirat HaLuchos. The Luchot of our Shatter. The two tablets of the testimony, written with the finger of God, who were broken and shattered into debris. In other words, Moses would have not attained Malchus if the tragedy of Shviras HaLuchos, the shattering of the Luchos, had not occurred. Moses would have been, if the tragedy hadn't taken place, the great prophet, the greatest of all teachers, redeemer, but not king. Kingdom was bestowed upon him after the first Luchos had been broken. And God told him to you two new tablets of stone from a hard rock, and told him to climb the mount once again in order to confront his creator once more. Why? What did Moses lack before Shviras HaLuchos that he had attained after that? And how did this tragic and heartbreaking event enhance Moses' personality and elevated him to the height of majesty? And I'll tell you what he lacked and what he gained. Moses, until the golden calf episode, has never failed. He was victorious until that time in all his undertakings. He was the messenger of fulfillment, the angel of realization. His message consisted of the joyous words for which the Jews were longing and yearning and waiting. Pocket pocket Israel. The double message of Gula, as Chazal say, Gula Tzua. His message was signed and sealed by the Shem Avaya, not Kehil Shaddai. What does the Shem Avaya symbolize? Fulfillment, realization. Kehil Shin Dalet Yud symbolizes promise, waiting, long waiting, Kehil Yezrach. Of course, every promise will be fulfilled. Every pledge will be implemented. But you have to wait. This was the destiny of Abraham. Moses' destiny was different. God revealed himself through the medium of Shem Avaya. Shem Avaya means immediate victory, immediate realization. There's no need to wait. Shem Avaya means complete victory over a normal event, over the causal nexus of historical events. He was the message. He was the fortunate prophet who brought with him the message of victory. He was the prophet who, when God simply radiated glory, the prophet of divine openness and revelation. His authority was not questioned, nor was it doubted. Vayar Yisrael Shadashan Fraim, Vayiro Nefadishem, Vayaminu Badishem, Uvimei Shehadei. The pillar of fire, the pillar of triumph, was marching in front, and the pillar of cloud, symbol of protection and safety, behind Moses. Victory in Malchus, in the opinion of Yahadus, are two contradictory, mutually exclusive concepts. As long as man is always victorious, as long as man is always triumphant, as long as his endeavors are blessed with success continually, as long as he continues to search ahead without being stopped and made to retreat, he cannot attain Malchus together with Kedusha, the highest degree of Malchus. Because Malchus, in whose texture Gdusha is interwoven, cannot be attained if all battles are won. If all undertakings are realized, are carried out, if all promises are fulfilled, and all dreams come true. The king, in order to attain the pinnacle of Malchus, one must be crushed, defeated, his aspirations are shambles, his dreams, visions, and hopes a heap of ashes. In order to rise from that heap of ashes and ascend the throne of majesty and kingship, Moses could not achieve Malchus as long as his course to greatness was straight, without alterations, angles, or curves. As long as there was continuous ascent, upward movement, aliyah, when all aspirations were coming true, hope seemed to be in process of realization, visions appeared to turn into realities, Moses could not attain the pinnacle of Malchus. And Moses couldn't be just a king. He could be either the greatest of all kings, or not to be a king at all. Only when the voice of God, Lech, Lech, get thee down, Kishiret Amcho, for thy people have dealt corruptly. Toss him back from his heroically conquered, exalted position and points of vantage. Only when Moses realized that he had failed, miserably failed, his must be the first master. His people he brought out of Egypt, Shiret Amcho, thy people, not my people, were not ready for Kabbalah Sadeh. Only then, when he in black despair and desolation, he threw away the luchas and broke them, only then he was, only when he was rejected by God, and also, denied, rejected by the people, only then he was anointed king. It is God's will. Why is it so? It's God's will that man should not achieve what he is meant to achieve without being once defeated, at least once defeated, without failing in losing his very existential security, without relapsing to lower levels of being, without experiencing Hester Ponim, the hiding of the face, what the mystics of the Middle Ages used to call the lonely dark night of the soul, without finding himself in front of tightly closed gates of heaven and just hearing the echo of one's own voice coming back from dark, uncharted spaces. Shvira Saluches is an integral part. Is an integral part of human destiny. God decreed man to fail when he addressed himself to Adam and told him, the gates vidada tatsmiachloch, thorns and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. In the sweat of thy brow shall thou eat bread till thou return unto the ground. Everybody, great or small, is subject to God's dictum. None can escape and none can acquire greatness. Not even Moses, the greatest and the most glorious of all teachers, without experiencing defeat and failure. Yahadus taught men not only how to accept failure and not to get lost, not only how to be defeated and not to disintegrate, not only how to be crushed and not to be overcome by black despair and resignation, but also how to rise after one had fallen, how to pick himself up, how to pick oneself up without help after one has been thrown from the top of the mount into the bottomless abyss. And Yahadus taught man how to assemble patiently the debris of the shattered luchas and restore their original integrity. Or how to use new tablets from the hard rock, and how to climb a steep mound rising above a black gaping precipice alone. How to replace one's steps at the mark, finding and curving paths, and how to wait for the Almighty